Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. But I'm not a hungover dude.
I'm not hungover exactly right now.
Well, let's just say we met at noon, or we're going to meet at noon to do this podcast, and we're starting now at 5 o'clock because it took that long to straighten you up.
That's true, but it did involve a pool and some floats and, you know,
soft drinks and time, naps.
It's been a nice lazy Sunday.
Yeah, I'll say. 5 hours later, here we are, ready to record the podcast.
I knew I wasn't getting off lightly with that one.
The things I have to go through to keep this boy straight. Boy, I tell you what.
Well, we had some friends in town, and we felt obliged to kind of take them to all the different cool bars in town to show.
Felt obliged to get ripped, huh?
Well, not really. I mean, it's just at my age, it doesn't take much to feel bad the next day. That's the unfortunate thing.
I'm so old, I can't get hungover. I feel like that every day. It's no different from any other time when I wake up.
Yeah, well, we went to a bunch of different craft beer bars around town because we've got a pretty good selection of them now.
Well, it sounds like you got pretty crafty.
We did. We got around. We're crafty. We're always down.
Yeah. Down for the tap.
So last week we were talking about the Sixth Amendment, and that kind of led into a discussion talking about guilty pleas, because really when you go over when the judge is taking a guilty plea, they want to make sure that you understand the Sixth Amendment and what's going on with it as far as a defendant, and you're giving up a lot of rights under it. So we thought, after talking about guilty pleas, the next thing that goes on is sentencing. So we'll talk about sentencing today.
All right. Not like writing a sentence, huh?
No.
Sentence structure. You remember diagramming sentences?
I was just about to ask you that. Yeah.
What was the point of that?
I don't know.
In your whole lawyer life, have you ever diagrammed a sentence?
I have not.
There's so many things they teach you in school that you never need, and there's so many things they don't teach you in school that you do need.
I mean, a gerund. What's up with a gerund?
A gerund?
Yeah.
I don't even know what a gerund is.
It's a part of speech, isn't it?
I don't know. Maybe they hadn't invented them back when I was in school. That might be like new math. That's new English or something like that.
Sister Mary Michael made us diagram.
We used to have to do that all the time.
Yeah.
That was stupid.
She had us read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, too, and like highlight it. And then we had to diagram sentences out of that. I mean, we spent a whole semester on that one book. It was crazy.
Did they ever teach you how to manage a budget or balance a checkbook, though, or anything like that?
Well, my senior year of high school, I took a class called Consumer Mathematics.
Yeah.
And that was because I was lazy and didn't want to take calculus. So for my math, I took Consumer Mathematics. And basically, we did balancing checkbooks, like how to write checks.
Well, see, that's a useful thing to learn in school.
It was. It was a good class.
They never taught anything like that when I was in school.
It was such an easy A, too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, now they had like home ec for girls to take. Guys couldn't take it. Only girls. This is how gendered society was then.
Yeah.
And so they could all learn how to cook and sew, because that's what girls do when they grow up, right? They cook and sew.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
They did away with that. Probably when Title IX or whatever it is came along, that's when that probably got done.
Well, you know, it was interesting. Being hungover, we were talking about, today, I was upstairs talking to Sydney, and we were talking about how when she got married, that they were going to change, Justin was going to change his name to Smurl McElroy, so they'd have the same last name.
Right.
And that basically she could do it for free because she got married.
Right.
But he couldn't do it because it was only for women. That's what the clerk told her, only for women. And I was thinking to myself, like, that's kind of crazy, but I bet that law has changed now.
Yeah, I don't think that's
because with same-sex marriage. I mean,
yeah,
how does that even make sense?
Yeah, I think that you can legally change your name anyway. There's a process.
You can, but basically you'd have to file. you have to publish a notice in the newspaper for 2 weeks. You have to go to a hearing before the judge, and you have to pay a filing fee. But it's included for free, basically, when you get married.
Right.
So, you know.
But it only works one way.
Yeah. If for one person, evidently. Yeah. You can't do two. I don't know. Well, anyway, I'm off on a tangent, but I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, you know, we're still winding our way back to sobriety.
That's true. So the sentencing phase is what comes after the guilty plea. And so when somebody enters a plea of guilt, that's usually one hearing. And then usually the judge will set out a sentencing for it about 45 days out later. They very rarely do they just go ahead and sentence the person right there when they take the guilty plea. Now, they can, and I've seen it done before, but that's kind of the not common.
Lesser offenses, yeah, like misdemeanors maybe that you have something pleaded or something like that, then a lot of times they'll wrap it all up right there.
Yeah, or if it's if somebody has spent a lot of time and they're being sentenced to time served, so basically that would be, you know, well, I'm going to sentence you to what you've already done, so that resolves it.
Right.
So that might be an instance, but yeah, usually what the judge will do is they'll set out a sentencing 30 or 45 days later, and almost always what they'll do is they'll say, I feel that I would be aided by the by a pre-sentence investigation report. So what they'll do is they'll instruct somebody from the probation department. They'll be in the courtroom too, and they'll say that officer so-and-so wants you to do a pre-sentence investigation on the defendant. And what the pre-sentence investigation is they'll come in for a meeting with the probation officer. The defendant will. I'm not there. Like, the lawyer's not there. But they'll take a family history from them. They'll talk about the history of the history of the crime. They'll ask, in the defendant's own words, like, what did you do wrong, basically, to, you know, what's the problem here? What's the co-defendant's version of events? They'll talk about their, like I said, their family history. They'll take, of course, all their biological data, like their birthday, their social security number, things like that, address, phone number.
How about crime history?
Well, I'm getting to that. Then they do a criminal history too. So they go through and they'll do like a NCIC background check to determine.
That's NCIS.
And so what they'll do is they'll
with SVU.
Yeah, SVU. They'll contact different states if anything pops up and try to get the records of what's going on there, and they'll list how many times they've been arrested, how many times they've been convicted, and things like that. And then at the very end, they'll list the different sentencing options that are available to the judge. So here, you know, you can give the person probation, you can sentence them to, you know, a year in prison, you can sentence them to home confinement. There's all these kind of weird sentences too, where you can sentence them to serve the weekends in jail and not the week. And that doesn't really happen ever, but they lay out all the different possibilities that the judge can sentence them to. Mm-hmm. And, there's also one section too. It's a confidential section that the defendant and the lawyer don't get to see, but it's basically from the probation department directly to the judge. And
they never get to see it?
No. It's supposedly their private recommendation. So,
well, I don't think that sounds right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you don't know what they might put in. They might have something that's not true in there. You don't have a chance to challenge it.
Yeah. Well, when you get the PSI too, you basically go over it with your client and you make sure that everything's straight in there. Actually, I had one not too long ago where it was a big deal because my guy pled to a felony and we said this is his first felony. And basically, since it was his first felony and it wasn't a violent crime, I thought he was probably going to get probation because, you know, he's didn't really have a bad criminal history. But evidently, when they did this pre-sentence investigation, the probation officer did a background search on him and looked like he had had a prior felony before. And my client was like, no, it was not a felony. I was charged with a felony, but it was dropped to a misdemeanor. This is my first felony. You know, I've never had a felony. So I actually had to contact the clerk of court down in Tennessee where it took place and get it squared away. And it turns out my client was right. And I found out that basically the court that he entered was actually the lower court, like our magistrate court. So it couldn't have been a felony because you can't do felonies in the lower court. Like, mm-hmm. You can't do that here. So I was able to explain that to the judge and say, no, this is in fact his first felony. So it made kind of a big deal for his.
Well, sounds like where there's smoke, there's fire. It sounded like he was nibbling at getting worse anyway.
He was. And a lot of times with people, you can see kind of their criminal history actually develop and escalate.
Mm-hmm.
There's some truth to that. Mm-hmm. They also have this one kind of interesting thing where they talk about how likely is the person to recidivize. And what they do is they look at like who their associates are, their criminal history, their family history, and things like that, and they give them a score.
Mm-hmm.
And then the higher the number, the more likely they are to
do it again
or get in trouble again. So it's always
go back, Jack, kind of do it again.
Yeah. I had one client, and he was not a good person. he had had a lot of...
Did he pay his bill?
Yeah.
Then he's an okay person.
Yeah. I had no problems with him. He got into a lot of trouble, and his criminal history section was thick.
Now, yeah.
Usually, these things are about 12 to 15 pages. That's like the normal thickness. Mm-hmm. I mean, his was probably 20, 25 pages. It was a thick PSI.
This guy was a busy dude.
Yeah, I mean, he had a horrible criminal history. And I was trying to...
So you said, Your Honor, you should bury him under the prison.
No, I said, Judge, if you look at his PSI, I said, this thing is thick as a book. And the judge just kind of looked at me, and I said, but the important thing you want to look at, Judge, like all good books, is the happy ending. So let's turn to the very last page about the sentencing options. I just tried to, I said, he would be an excellent candidate for home incarceration.
Man, you tried to gloss that one over.
I did. I said, like any good book, let's go straight to the ending.
but do you really want a dude like that on home confinement and available to the general public?
That guy could have cured cancer. The judge was going to sentence him to prison. I mean, there was good. It didn't matter what I said.
Sound like he needs it. A lot of it.
So it was kind of funny, but so basically the sentence, the judge will hear you have a chance to put on evidence that you want at the sentencing. So like basically if my client wants to take the stand, I can ask them questions and they can show remorse as to what took place. We can call other witnesses, like maybe they've started going to church, so they might call the pastor or something like that and say, well, you know, in the past month he's come around and he's really shown a lot of promise, we're working with him, you know, just different things like that to try to show the judge that the client has turned their life around or doing things properly.
He's got potential, Judge.
Yeah, and so you have that, and then
I hate that kind of stuff. To me, that stuff is so fake. I found God because I'm going to jail and it benefits me, so I found God.
Well, yeah. Some people, I think, will say anything just to not go to prison.
Yeah, that's right. People will do that. Exactly.
Alternatively, too, the prosecution likewise gets to put on evidence. So they might call the victim and let the victim make a statement or things like that. And sometimes, as part of the plea deal, the prosecution will agree to remain silent at sentencing, which is always kind of a nice thing because you get to make your argument and then they don't say basically anything to... back to it. But I mean, it's kind of a nice thing, but at the same time too,
that's usually if there's a plea deal already in place. So
oh yeah,
it really doesn't have much impact on what they're going to do. They've already decided that. It just gives a guy a chance to kind of clear his name a little bit or something.
What it does is it gives you a chance to argue for an alternative sentence like probation or home confinement as opposed to a prison sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not saying like, well, this guy'd be a great candidate for home confinement, blah blah blah, and then the prosecutor stands up and said, Judge, you need to put this person in prison. Like, you know, they're not going to do that.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times the prosecutors know that the judges are going to do what they're going to do, regardless of whether they're going to see this PSI, and they might not even really need to say anything. But mm-hmm. It's still kind of nice when the prosecutor agrees to remain silent at sentencing.
Yeah, I've seen ones like that on Judge Judy, that the plaintiff keeps wanting to speak up,
mm-hmm.
and they're winning. And yeah. Judge Judy is like, the best thing you can do is keep your mouth shut. You're winning right now. Have you heard me say anything to go against you? Just keep your mouth shut. Oh. When you're winning, that's the best thing to do.
Oh, I had a guy at sentencing a couple weeks ago and got him probation by the skin of his teeth. Like, he was just a screw up. And he kept wanting to talk and talk. And I looked over and I was like, just shut up. I was like, shut up. Like, just stop talking. Like, you're not helping your case here. So, you know, I've got you probation. You don't need to say anything else.
Let a professional handle this.
Yeah, it's like, just, you need to stop talking. You've already got probation, so nothing else good can come from this.
Yeah, that's what I love. It was, I wish I could remember what it was that she was using as an example, but she was using this example, and every time the guy would go to speak, she would say this term that to remind him, you're winning, just keep your mouth shut if you want to win. You're not going to help yourself, believe me.
Now, I think there was one section of the sentencing you had done a little bit of research about. It's kind of derived from common law and been handed down. But I think before that, there might be a pending motion before the court.
Why, yes, if it please the court, we would like to approach the bench to pay court costs before you sentence us to life in prison or whatever you're going to do.
I'm not going to sentence you.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
I'm going to sentence you to buy a Sleep Number bed.
That's right. We're approaching for our good friends from Sleep Number, the beds of the future.
And it's not just a bed, it's proven quality sleep. I'll tell you what, I love whenever my head hits my Sleep Number pillow, because I know it's adjusted just for me.
There's nothing more comfortable. You can make it bigger or smaller and firmer or softer. Whatever you like.
Wow, you're just throwing up softballs here.
That's right. Whatever kind of balls you like, we've got them.
For proven quality sleep, there's a Sleep Number 360 smart bed. Queen mattresses start at just $9.99.
You need to feel the difference. So many couples disagree on mattress firmness. Sleep Number 360 smart beds let you choose your ideal firmness on each side, so it's just right for both of you.
The Sleep Number 360 smart beds are so smart.
How smart are they?
I knew you were going to do that. They sense your every move and automatically adjust to you, keeping you sleeping comfortably throughout the night.
Sleep Number has been ranked number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses by J.D. Power. For 2018 award information, visit jdpower.com.
Come in now and save up to $600 on Sleep Number 360 smart beds. You'll only find Sleep Number at one of their 575 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Find the one nearest you at sleepnumber.com/court.
That's sleepnumber.com/court. Mike and Tommy say, nighty night, little buckaroos.
All right, Tommy, so what do you know about sentencing?
Well, I know a little bit about sentencing. When I first got this thing...
I used to diagram them.
That's right. I used to diagram those things. Never knew why. Never did a good job. But we did it. The first thing that I came across was something called allocution.
Yeah.
And I thought that was just involved in the death penalty when they send electricity through you. But then I found out that's electrocution. So allocution is totally different and doesn't involve electrocution.
Hopefully it doesn't involve electrocution. If it involves electrocution, you do not allocute very well.
That's right. If you get electrocuted after allocuting, then you have failed at allocuting.
So what is allocuting?
Allocution allows the defendant to explain why the sentence should be lenient. In plea bargains, an allocution may be required of the defendant. The defendant explicitly admits specifically and in detail the actions and their reasons in exchange for a reduced sentence. In principle, that removes any doubt as to the exact nature of the defendant's guilt in the matter. The term allocution is used generally only in jurisdictions in the United States, but there are vaguely similar processes in other common law countries. In many other jurisdictions, it is for the defense lawyer to mitigate on his client's behalf, and the defendant rarely has the opportunity to speak. The rights of victims to speak at sentencing is also sometimes referred to as allocution. Now, it says that Australia also has it, and it follows the term allocutus, and is used by the clerk of arraigns or another formal associate of the court. It is generally phrased as, "Prisoner at the bar, you have been found guilty by a jury of your peers of the offense of XYZ. Do you have anything to say as to why the sentence of this court should not now be passed upon you?" The defense counsel will then make a plea in mitigation, also called submissions on penalty, in an attempt to mitigate the relative seriousness of the offense and heavily refer to and rely upon the defendant's previous good character and good works, if any.
If any.
The right to make a plea in mitigation is absolute. If a judge or magistrate, now this is in Australia, If a judge or magistrate refuses to hear such a plea or does not properly consider it, the sentence can be overturned on appeal.
Really?
Now, not the conviction,
right,
but the sentence.
Yeah, that makes sense. It gives the person a chance to talk about it. So, and that's a very similar process to here in the U.S., really.
Right. So they get to stand up and speak, but then it's kind of in more current times where they've offered these victims impact statements.
Right.
Because before, all you could do was just attend the trial and you know, be horrified as they go back through the events or whatever. But now they actually have victim impact statements where you can stand up and say, this is what's happened to me,
yeah,
as a result of all this.
Yeah, and sometimes that'll be in the PSI too. They'll be talk about the victims, like especially if there was some sort of theft or things like that, they want to know that basically the person reimbursed the whatever restitution there was for whatever damage they caused, things like that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that always gets me too. They say that part of it may be that they, when you're going through the sentencing part, that they make you pay, if you lose, you know, you're the guy that lost, you're the defendant, make you pay either restitution to the victims or you also have to pay your probation officer.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're going to jail. How are you going to pay anybody? I don't understand, because most criminals, I don't think, have like big bank accounts, and they got stocks and bonds and stuff that they can draw from these things.
Home confinement, too, costs a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money to be in home confinement.
I don't see how anybody expects these people to ever pay those things.
Well, and that's part of the problem when there's like court costs and fines levied on these people. They get out of prison, and maybe they're on parole or things like that, and they're supposed to pay these fees, and they can't afford it. That's actually grounds to send them back.
Yeah, because it violates your probation if you don't pay your probation fee.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's one of those things that basically...
It's a catch-22.
It is, and it's kind of a unfortunate situation. But, you know, basically, if a person is doing everything they can, but they don't pay their probation fees and things like that, they're usually not going to violate the person just on that.
But still, you got that hanging over your head.
You do.
If that's the case, and, you know, sometimes people just don't like people. And it's perfectly within their rights, and they didn't pay their fee, drag them in. Like I say, maybe if they're doing everything else right, you don't want to fool with that, right. But it's still there.
Yeah, but I know that if a probation officer brought in a probation violation just on not paying the fees in front of the judge, I don't even know the prosecutor would even file that. The prosecutor,
really?
I don't think so.
But, I mean, it's on the books.
It is.
It's a law. Why would they do it? I mean, I know I'm arguing both sides of this. One, I'm saying it's not fair, and the other side, I'm saying, but if it's there, it's there. What I'm saying is, I think there's something wrong. I think that's something that should be looked at.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't expect somebody to do it. Now, once they're out and on their own, okay, maybe then some of these things should kick in, but not while you're still on probation or something.
Yeah. Well, it can be a vicious cycle.
Yeah. I mean, it's a way you could keep somebody in prison forever, basically, if you really wanted to.
Yeah. Well, and it tends to make them more likely to recidivize as well.
Sure, because if you feel hopeless, and whatever you do, you're going to lose anyway, why not grab for the brass ring?
Yeah. That's one thing, too. West Virginia does have like a three strikes, you're out type law in the books, where if you have multiple felonies, the penalties can be enhanced. Mm-hmm. So basically, any crime you commit has pretty much some sort of prison sentence guideline out there. Federal sentencing guidelines are crazy. I mean, they're really hard to decipher, but the state ones basically just have like a West Virginia code and say, hey, if you commit burglary, it's a 1-5 indeterminate sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to talk about indeterminate versus determinate sentences here in a second too. But basically, if you plead to something, it's a 1-5 and it's a felony. It's your second felony, it can be enhanced. They can double the sentence basically. And if it's your third time, then you could actually get 15
life in prison
with mercy. So it'd be like, mm-hmm. you know, 15 years. So
is that the minimum if you get life with mercy?
Yeah. Yeah. There might be some sort of guideline, too, where you have to serve a mandatory minimum portion of it as well if you're being recidivized. But I'm not certain, because usually you get like day-for-day good time credit.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, if you have a 4-year sentence, you're basically going to serve two before you're out.
Well, that's another one that I could argue both sides of, too, that the three-strike law, in some ways, I agree with it completely. That if you've got somebody that's just a career criminal and they've shown that no matter how long you put them in, when they come out, they're going to go back to it, then society's better off for you to remove them from the streets.
Yeah.
Even if the crime they commit in and of itself doesn't constitute that, they've shown they're going to be a hazard to everybody. However, there are times where you may fall under that because you've committed three crimes, and really the sum of the three crimes really doesn't equal a life sentence.
No.
I mean, you know, they're minor things, and maybe you were in the wrong place at the wrong time for something. I mean, maybe you just had bad luck. I don't know, but I think that there's people that can get trapped, but where's the gray area? There's no, I mean, you either are or you aren't.
Well, I had a client, and he did not have a good criminal history. He had a bad criminal history, but he was adamant that the crime I was representing for, that basically he didn't do it.
I've done a lot of crap. And you maybe didn't catch me, but this one I didn't do.
Well, and he was well known by the sheriff's office and the prosecutor's office as somebody who had been in trouble before.
You don't want to be well known.
And they even said, this doesn't seem like his MO. And also, he's pretty much always admitted whenever he's done it. I mean, he's come in and just said, yeah, whatever. But he didn't admit this. Not, I got to tell you, I went through the evidence, and I believe him. I really think he was truly innocent. And it was a case I was actually looking forward to trying because I had a good chance of winning it. But the problem was his record was so bad that basically if we did not win, then he was facing recidivism.
Life in prison.
Yeah. Man. And it was one of those hard choices that I said, hey, here's the deal. I think you got a strong case and I think I can win this case. But we don't know.
Well, it's what a high risk and a high reward.
We don't know what a jury's going to do.
Yeah.
Here's what I think, and what do you want to do? And he ended up taking the plea, and they took the recidivism off the table, and that was one of the things. Like,
right.
So, you know, and he had already had some time in and things like that. But he entered, and I wanted to talk about this too. He entered what's called a Kennedy plea here in West Virginia, mm-hmm. basically where you don't admit guilt. You wouldn't allocute like you had said. What he basically said was the charges against me and the evidence against me is so strong that I'm going to go ahead and enter a guilty plea to it.
A Kennedy plea, which was named after John F. Kennedy, because he said, "Ask not what crime I committed against you, but what leniency you can give me."
That's not true.
What he said?
Don't write that down, folks. It's called an Alford plea in other places too, probably more commonly. I think in West Virginia it's just called a Kennedy plea. But so that was the plea deal we worked out with him, that he would enter this Kennedy plea, because he really couldn't say I did it, because I think he honestly would have been lying if he had said he did it. So, you know, that's what it was perfect for. And I know we've talked about Kennedy pleas before, and there's been some talk about it in the local press recently because of certain cases that were going on here in town where a guy had entered a Kennedy plea and mm-hmm. got probation, and was, you know, a lot of people were up in arms about that.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about Kennedy pleas? I mean, you said you don't like them, right?
No, I don't like them. I don't. I mean, in a lot of the cases, the guy's guilty and he doesn't have to admit guilt. He can just say, "Hey, you got enough evidence to convict me. I'm not going to admit it, but I will accept this much of a sentence."
Right.
And I feel like most of the time they get off light. That's why they're taking it. But the other thing is they don't have this on their record. And it's something, in a lot of cases, it's serious that they did, and they don't really have it on their record as that they did this.
Well, they can still deny it.
Right. But, I mean, they're not guilty of a felony, per se, when they do that.
Oh, they're judged guilty.
Well, they're judged guilty, but they never admitted their guilt.
That's right. But, I mean, it does. Basically what it says is, in order for the judge to accept a guilty plea, I guess we should talk about this on our guilt or plea section last week, maybe, but in order for the judge to accept a plea, basically the defendant has to give a factual basis as to why the judge can accept their guilty plea, that they did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, alternatively, in a Kennedy plea or an Alford plea, basically what happens is the person says, you know, I don't have any defenses, there's so much evidence. So then the judge turns to the prosecutor and says, well, what would the prosecution's case show? And the prosecution will say, well, we believe on such date in such county here in West Virginia that the evidence would show that the defendant so-and-so did feloniously break the law by, doing whatever we say he did. We have evidence that would show he was there at the time and this, that, and the other. And the judge will say, okay, well.
Motive and opportunity. Yeah.
And the judge will say, okay, well, I believe that there is a factual basis to accept this plea, and I'm going to go ahead and accept it. So that's kind of how the Kennedy plea works.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something on the record as showing what the state believes they would be able to approve. But as far as, and they do have it on, it's not like it doesn't show up on the record. I mean, so basically if you did a PSI on somebody, it would show that they entered a Kennedy plea mm-hmm. to something. But, I think it has a place for sure.
Well, in a twist of a different kind, I don't know what they called this plea exactly, but we talked about the West Memphis Three mm-hmm. before, those three teenage boys that were accused of killing those three second grade boys, and they were rounded up, and it was the satanic panic and all that kind of stuff. And after they were in prison for like 15 years or more, something like that, 17 years or something, they finally had gotten to the point where they were going to be able to overturn the conviction. They had called enough evidence into question that they were going to have to go to a retrial. At that time, they offered them, this was a brand new prosecutor that had just taken office, and the other prosecutor just absolutely refused to hear anything. But he let them take a plea, and they had to state in the plea that they were guilty of this crime.
Right.
Even though they weren't. But even though they stated that we have to admit that we're guilty, but we still maintain we're innocent. And it's like, how can you say both of those?
Right.
But that they had to say they were guilty, but they were also allowed to maintain they were innocent. And then as soon as they did that, then they let them out with time served.
Right. Well, that might have been also from some sort of civil point of view that they didn't want to get sued for any kind of wrongful prosecution.
Exactly. The city or whatever, yeah, county or whatever it was, yeah, under, to sue them because they had them in prison for 17 years wrongfully. But once you said you're guilty, then you can't turn around and say they improperly incarcerated me.
Yeah, but I think you could still probably sue them. It would just be an extra hurdle. Because in a civil case, you would just basically say that there was undue influence, that they were forced to do it. And if given that situation, what would you do?
Yeah, I mean, you've been in prison 17 years, yeah, and you've got a chance to get out, you'd go ahead and do it. But it would still leave a bad taste in your mouth, especially if you lost 17 years of your life unjustly.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a – I mean, I understand probably that's why they did it, but I think you could probably get around that pretty easily, arguing that to a court. So at least that's my thoughts about it. I had another case where a client – was under the influence of drugs and actually didn't remember being there or doing anything either. So, I mean, obviously, he wanted to take the plea deal, but he couldn't say, I'm guilty. And I'd had to explain to the prosecutors, like, yeah, he can't. I mean, it's going to have to be a candy plea because he can't remember what happened. And they're like, well, okay, that's fine.
And they said meth is a powerful drug.
Yeah. Heroin's even stronger.
Yeah.
So there are some good uses for candy pleas. I know we had talked about it before, and I kind of wanted to talk about that. But I will tell you, also, if you take a candy plea, sometimes it backfires. Because when you go in front of a judge for sentencing, mm-hmm, and it's up to the judge doesn't necessarily like to see that you took a candy plea. They like to see the fact that you actually owned up and accepted responsibility, like you're saying, for allocution. So I think it can backfire, too, when people take candy pleas or Alford pleas. It doesn't show any remorse. You can't say.
You're not accepting responsibility, and some judges don't like that, huh?
Yeah, and you can't say, basically arguing a sentence, I'm sorry, because you can't apologize for something you're not admitting you did. So it's kind of a catch-22, and, I don't always advise clients to do them because I think it's sometimes better to go in front of them and just own up to what you did. A lot of times, too, they'll be necessary because they'll be co-defendants, and part of the plea deal, if there is a plea deal, would be that you agree to testify truthfully and give a statement about what took place. So that allows them to use that as evidence in the other case if that person's not taking a plea deal. So if you have one defendant that takes a plea deal, it's like a house of cards. Usually the case kind of falls apart pretty quick because it's hard to get around that. Now, you can always, we talked about this before, discredit a co-defendant on a witness stand who took a plea deal and things like that. But
sure.
But it's hard. You don't necessarily want to be doing that. So
one of the things that's always gotten me, and I don't understand how you distinguish this, is when somebody has been charged with multiple crimes.
Right.
And so they were charged with three different things, and they're found guilty of three different things. And then they sentence them. They don't just get one sentence. They get a sentence for each individual crime.
Right. Because basically each section of code you broke, there's a specific penalty for breaking that section.
Right. And then they determine that those sentences will be served concurrently or consecutively.
Yeah.
So you got 3 5-year terms. You could actually serve them concurrently, and you're out in 5 years or less.
Yeah.
Whereas if they make you serve them consecutively, that's 15 years, unless you get out for good behavior or something like that.
Right. Yeah, and actually I was going to bring that up to talk about, because that's one very important thing, talking about sentencing. It's not unusual to see somebody charged with conspiracy and with the actual commission of the crime. Mm-hmm. And so you might get the conspiracy charge in that. And then at sentencing, unless it's part of the plea deal that you took, or if you're convicted at a jury trial, at sentencing, you have to argue basically why the judge should run them concurrently. So run them together.
Yeah. I mean, in my mind, if they're all part of the same thing, mm-hmm, like, a conspiracy, all right, you plan this with some other people, then you executed it. All right, that may be two different crimes, mm-hmm, that you did, but I mean, in effect, it was all one thing.
Yeah.
So to me, okay, consecutively, because it was all part of the same thing, but I mean, or concurrently. But if it's three separate things, like they got you for breaking into this store, and they got you for pistol whipping some guy, and they got you for carjacking somebody, those were three separate things. You should serve three separate terms.
There'd also probably be a finding of using a firearm, commission of a crime, which is an enhancement.
Yeah.
There was one judge that the judge ran, it was something similar to that. There were three different felonies convicted at a jury trial. The judge ran them all consecutively, meaning finding them back to back to back. And there was a firearm used, and the judge enhanced each of them because there was a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
And the case law actually got overturned. The case law said that you can only do that to one of them.
Oh, not all three.
Yeah, he couldn't do it all three. But yeah, the judge teed that person up with those.
I mean, it seems to me 9 times out of 10, when you hear about it, they say that they do them, the sentences are passed for concurrent.
Yeah.
Instead of consecutive. And I don't understand, unless it's a really heinous crime, mm-hmm. you know, like somebody's a serial killer and they found them guilty of killing 10 people and give them 10 life sentences or something yeah. like that, and serve consecutive, then they do it. But when it's just regular criminals that are doing the thing, it seems like they're almost always concurrent.
My friend is an attorney, and he was appointed to represent this guy who was a sex offense with, like, minor pictures and things like that. Mm-hmm. And those cases historically always have just so many counts, because each picture is a separate
right.
Criminal offense. Uh-huh. So he pled to, like, it was like 250 counts or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Judge Farrell gave this guy, I forget what sentence it was. So basically the way the judge sentenced him is that he got, essentially he was serving life. Because I think it was like, he was serving
251 year sentences.
Yeah, it was something like that. Oh, no, it wasn't like that. It was basically he had to serve like 15 years or something like that on each count. Mm-hmm. And the guy was a little bit older and had some health issues and things like that. And he asked the judge if he would run them concurrent. The judge's like, no, they're all running consecutive.
Yeah.
So the judge basically, like, you know, it was funny.
It was a really heinous crime. That's why they did it. But it's really got to be really heinous. And I don't know that. I mean, I think there's less than heinous that still meets that criteria of strictness.
Yeah.
You know? They had one guy that, you along the same lines what you just talked about, a guy that was like 80 years old that they convicted of a murder. Mm-hmm. He murdered his wife in front of somebody else or the son or something like that. And they found him guilty, but said that he was in too bad a shape and too old to serve the sentence. So they didn't make him go to prison, and he ended up killing somebody else.
Yeah. He's old enough to kill somebody. He's old enough to go to prison.
Yeah. It was like that old Richard Pryor routine. He's talked about how I was real strong back in them days. I was just strong enough to pick up my gun and shoot that guy in the ass.
Now, I did mention talking about prison sentences. There's two different kinds of prison sentences. So sometimes you'll read something and it'll say the penalty for this is a 1 to 5 indeterminate sentence. Or it might say it is a 1 to 5 determinate sentence. And what the difference is, if it's indeterminate, the judge just sentences them to the 1 to 5. And then basically that means they're eligible for parole after serving 1 year, but they can serve up to 5.
So they just come up for parole each year?
Yeah, based on the parole board's criteria. Now, alternatively, if it's a determinate, so the penalty for committing this crime is a 1 to 5 determinate sentence, the judge picks a number between 1 and 5, and that's what you get sentenced to, and that's what you serve.
And you can't come up for probation it's just 3, like if he said 3,
yeah.
You just serve 3 years, you can't get out before that, right. And you don't have to stay to the 5.
Correct.
I mean, even there's no decision to be made.
No. So basically a determinate sentence is a number set in stone. And, you know, if you had to serve a 3-year prison sentence in West Virginia, you would be probably out in 1.5, just because that's the way they give you credit for good time served. So it's an incentive. So
is that just so that they don't go around and kill each other in the prisons?
Probably, I guess. I don't know.
But I mean, that's another crime, and you'd be in there. If you're in there for 5 years, and you're not going to commit another crime and have to be there, you know, for murder. So I think that we're just giving away time. I think if they're sentenced to 5, they ought to be there for 5. Don't let them out for good behavior. They should have been behaving good in the first place, and they wouldn't be there.
Exactly.
That's the way I feel about it. That's the way I feel about it.
I know how you feel about it.
You know, it's just like, you know, the guy that you were talking about, how he didn't do that crime, but he had done a bunch of other ones, but he didn't do that one.
Yeah.
That's the way my dad was, like when my brother and I'd be in the back seat and a fight would break out. He'd just reach back and swat whoever he could reach. And he's like, I didn't do anything. Well, that's all right. You probably did it before.
Yeah.
So, you know, it all comes out in the wash.
Yeah, it just works itself out. It's okay.
Yeah, that's right. You may not have deserved it this time, but you probably deserved it the other time.
Yeah, one client, I'll never forget, I was sitting there talking to him, and he goes, all the stuff I've done in my life, you know, the one time I didn't do anything.
But you see, he put himself in that position.
Oh, he did.
The way he led the rest of his life, so he's got nobody to blame but himself.
Yeah.
Just go look in the mirror, dude. That's why.
Yeah, I mean, he was a likable guy, but yeah, he was a career criminal, had a lot of problems.
Well, you know what? Ted Bundy was a likable guy. You know, that's how he kept picking up all those girls, because he was such a likable guy.
Yeah. So when you're talking about sentencing and guidelines and things like that, I did touch on the federal sentencing guidelines.
Right.
And so basically, if you violate some sort of federal code, it tells you what the sentence is. But then there's also these different enhancements and subsections and things like that. I mean, it's an entire book based on the sentencing guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very detailed.
Like for certain crimes, if found convicted, you have to serve a certain number of years. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, but then they do like a score sheet too. So if you're convicted of this with this much, like this much weight of something, then it's going to be, you have to serve at least 36 months.
And that's in that PSI?
Well,
is that what they're drawing that weight that you're talking about from?
No, this is in federal court. So basically, well, I mean, I guess it would probably be in the PSI there too. But yeah, it would be part of the possible sentences that the judge could enforce against somebody or sentence them to. But they're really, when I say confusing, they're super confusing. I don't like going through them, but you know, you have to, because you have to know exactly what it is your client's facing so you can properly advise them. Now, one of the interesting things is that for the longest time, there was a difference between the weight ratio for sentencing for crack cocaine and just regular powder cocaine. Did you know about that or remember hearing about
that?
Yeah,
I remember hearing about that, yeah. It all ties together, you know, with the sentencing for marijuana laws and for the crack cocaine, because it was basically the U.S. government making a decision to incarcerate minorities. Because that's where it was aimed at, was the minorities that had the crack cocaine as opposed to regular cocaine, because it was the upper class guys that had the good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they had the weight disparity, and also there was a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence for simple possession of crack cocaine, which is crazy if you think about it.
I know.
But so this was back in 2010 that they actually passed the Fair Sentencing Act, and what it did, it got rid of that mandatory minimum and it changed the weights. So basically, because essentially it's the same drug,
right?
It
makes no sense.
Yeah.
The cheap drug, the one you could get for $5 on the street corner or $10 or something like that, you're going to put those people in more prison time than the guys that are buying the pure stuff and moving it for, you know, thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
It came about back in 1986, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where basically they thought crack cocaine was much more dangerous back then than powder cocaine. But basically, experts have shown that the effects were basically the same. So it's kind of exaggerated how dangerous crack cocaine was.
Did you ever watch the TV show Snowfall?
No, I did not.
That was very interesting. It was about the rise of crack cocaine as it started in Los Angeles. Now, I think that it's a totally fictionalized story,
right?
But it's based on actual events and things that happened. And the CIA was involved in bringing cocaine into the United States, and they didn't develop the crack cocaine, but they were involved with people that did develop crack cocaine, and it started proliferating.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a common conspiracy theory out there that basically was brought to racially motivated and things like that. I think there might have been some truth to it too, based upon
it's all tied to that Iran-Contra affair.
Exactly.
They were with Oliver North and when Reagan was in office, and they were trading drugs for weapons and things like that.
Yeah.
And all that was going on, and that was they were trying to subsidize the guerrilla army and overthrowing the government over there.
Yeah, I don't know that we know everything that took place with regards to that.
No, it's in the same place as this information on Area 51.
Yeah, which people are supposed to be storming that here before too long, I think, right?
Yeah, but I think that Trump's Space Force is going to hold him out. I think that's why he developed it.
Space Force! Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is a part of the show where I ask Tommy about different legal terms we talked about. And I'll tell you, about 3 or 4 hours ago, I don't think I would have thought I'd be doing legal briefs today. I was not feeling too high.
I know. I rested in my pool and on my sofa trying to nurse you back to health.
So I said there's two different types of sentences. There's indeterminate and determinate. What is the difference between those?
Indeterminate means like the judge can sentence you 1 to 5 years, and that means that after 1 year, you start getting probation hearings to see if you're out. But I guess by the time you reach 5, you get out.
Right. That's called killing it.
Killing it.
He killed it.
And then determinate means that he can sentence you to any number between 1 and 5 if he sentences you to a determinate one. And whatever number it is, you don't get out before that, but you do get out when you reach that.
We didn't talk about this. One thing that's kind of interesting. Well, I'll ask you the next question, then I'll get into it. What is the difference between concurrent and consecutive sentences?
Well, concurrent means that you serve them at the same time. You can get 3 15-year sentences, but you only serve 15 years mm-hmm. or less.
So you're serving them together.
So you're serving them at the same time. Yeah, together. Or consecutive means one after the other. So you got to serve one 15-year sentence before you start the next 15-year sentence. So in effect, it's a 45-year sentence.
I'll tell you where it gets really confusing is consecutive indeterminate sentences. So basically,
consecutive indeterminate. Oh, yeah. Because then you got to come up for probation on each or whatever on each one.
Yeah.
And then you start the next one.
Yeah. And there's some case law out there. I think you actually don't you actually have to serve the full term of the first one, I think, before you can be eligible for the next one. So it's really kind of a screwy thing. You can really mess with somebody giving them consecutive indeterminate sentences.
And that's one of the first things the other inmates ask you when you're in, how long you in for? He's and like, you have to say, I don't know.
I don't know, man.
It's indeterminate at this time.
I don't know, man. That judge really rang me up.
I'm hoping till tomorrow, but I don't really know.
I've been done rung up. Now, what is allocution?
Allocution is the defendant's right to make a statement before his sentencing to try to get the judge to sentence him for less years than what he probably deserves.
That's right. And the one key phrase that you mentioned a couple times I think is important to think about is it's mitigation. So really you're trying to mitigate you're trying to mitigate your exposure to what prison sentence you're going to get there.
Yeah, about how you found God now and you're leading a Christian life and you got a baby out there that you want to take care of even though you weren't paying child support before that and things like that. So,
oh, well, see, that's the kind of thing, too. Like, if you're arguing sentencing mm-hmm. and you go up there and you say, well, judge, he's got a kid to support and blah, blah, blah. Then the prosecutor stands up and says, well, we checked his child support records. He's $10,000 behind.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of like,
Yeah, but judge, I have every desire now to go earn that $10,000 and make that up plus more.
Yeah.
My son deserves that. If you only let me go this one time, you'll never see me again.
All right. So what is a PSI and what is contained in it? Final question.
Pounds per square inch. No. A PSI is your criminal history.
What does it stand for?
Personal score instructions.
Pre-sentence investigation.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah.
And it means that they're going to look at all your criminal history and determine what's your rate of recidivism and how likely you are to be rehabilitated and how long they think that you need. And also if you might come up for a three strike law or something like that.
That's true. It's never a good idea or a good thing to have a really thick PSI because that means the criminal history section's not so good.
Thick bacon, good. Thick PSI, not good. That's what they say at Arby's.
That's what they say at Arby's. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine podcasts.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out there, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.